Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock, and this is Barbara Ridenour with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated November 20th, 2015. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with City Offers $10 to Buy Decatur Library Building. City officials extended an offer Thursday to buy the Decatur Public Library Building, adding concrete terms to a previously expressed desire to own the facility. Under the proposal, the city would pay $10 for the building and annex at 130 North Franklin Street. The library would enter a 20-year lease with the city, with rent starting at $432,000 and increasing 5% every 5 years. In exchange, the city would provide for the repair and maintenance, capital improvements, and safeguarding of the facilities. The city would also continue to pay off the $735,000 in general obligation bonds that it issued in 1998 for library renovations. City Manager Tim Gleason presented the one-page offer letter to the library board at its regular meeting. He said the letter was prepared on behalf of Mayor Julie Moore Wolf and the Decatur City Council, who met in closed session to discuss the offer Monday. The library board plans to consider the deal and meet twice in December to finalize proposed terms of its own. It's sweet and simple, and the question is, can we get it to read in a form that satisfies everybody we know how to satisfy in terms of the future of the library? Board President John Phillips said after the meeting. Excuse me. Greg Zantara, the city's finance director and a library board member, said the city's upcoming 2016 budget proposal contains $400,000 to address the library's immediate capital needs. The city also plans to pay for an independent study of the library facility, Zantara said. Officials estimate ultimately spending another $2.5 million on the building, which could include renovations to unused space to accommodate a potential tenant. Gleason said the city would seek a tenant that would fit well into the downtown area and bring more people to the library. Our goal is not just to turn a profit, he said. Phillips pointed out that council members failed Monday to adopt three new revenue streams proposed by Gleason, rejecting increased liquor license fees and tabling votes on a gas tax and video gaming fees. The clearly unfair question is, how can we be assured that the city has that kind of money, that they can come up with it, or are willing to come up with it, asked Gleason. How do we get belief that this is going to get done? Gleason told Phillips that the city could get a short-term loan of $2.5 million to $3 million for the improvements. We've got the ability to do that, and it will happen. The board can be assured of that. And more so than me saying that, the mayor and council are saying that, Gleason said. This is the second round of intergovernmental negotiations over the future of the library building. The library board previously agreed to sell to the Decatur Public Building Commission, with Macon County offices slated to move in and lease unused space on the second floor and in the annex. The plan stalled after council members raised concerns earlier this year and told Gleason to explore alternatives. The initial proposal would have capped the library's rent at $615,000 per year, including utility costs. The city's proposal does not include utilities in the rent. Zantara said the city would work with the library to help make energy efficiency improvements and keep utility bills down. Both he and Gleason referred to the library and city as family. We just feel that from the city side, with this relationship going the way that it's going, opens up opportunities for additional funding for the library operations in the future, Zantara said. I can't specifically say what may be and when that may be, but we just think it gives us more opportunities. We can share the benefits. City librarian Rick Meyer said, not only would the library's rent increase over time, but utility costs would likely go up. What we've got looks to me like a slightly more expensive 20 years. Probably not terribly, but a slightly more expensive 20 years. With each passing year, it's going to be a little bit less of a good deal, Meyer said. Zientara said Meyer was right, but there would be significant savings at the end of the lease under the city's plan. He said the library would face $980,000 in rent in the 21st year of the building commission's proposal, while rent would be $505,000 at that time under the city's. As a board member, that's a nice insurance policy for me, knowing that in 20 years, likely just saved $500,000 a year, Zientara said. Jim Alpe, the former library board president, addressed the board during public comments with several factors to consider, including the potential fate of the dilapidated annex building. Residents previously objected to demolishing it, he said, which was one option Gleason mentioned. He also liked the board to consider having its attorney build language into the lease to ensure the library remained a priority for the city. As much as we might want to consider ourselves all family and all part of the community, history in the last several years has shown that the city, when in a pinch, will cut resources, he said, and the library has been part of those cuts for several years. Residents who want to offer thoughts and concerns to the library board can email them to board@decaturlibrary.org. That's board@decaturlibrary.org by December 3rd. The board plans to meet December 9th to discuss its priorities, then again December 17th to vote on language to send to the city. No other actions have been taken. We haven't closed any doors, Phillips said. We're just moving forward with the proposal that we got and seeing what we can do to make the very best of it for the library. Everlasting legacy. Late naturalist left her mark on Weldon Springs. Clinton. Whether wading into swampy water to explain the complexities of nature to a child, or guiding small hands on properly grasping a fishing pole, Carol Thompson believes she had the best job in the world. Before her death in July, Thompson spent 3 decades as a site interpreter at Weldon Springs State Park, southeast of Clinton. After 13 years as a volunteer, the state hired Thompson as the park's first interpreter in 1997. During her years as a volunteer, Thompson helped raise money in 1988 to move the one-room Union Schoolhouse to the park from Logan County. The schoolhouse is a replica of a 1865 classroom and also houses Thompson's taxidermy collection. Many of the animals were stored in Thompson's home before they made it to the taxidermist, recalled her daughter, Lauren Thompson. We had a freezer and a deep freeze with the most random things in it. My friends thought that it was really cool, said Thompson, adding a stuffed beaver went to her kindergarten class for show and tell. Next door to the schoolhouse is the former Texas Township Town Building, moved to the park in 1995. That serves as the interpretive center and the educational hub for Thompson's extensive nature collection. Butterfly nets lean against a corner of the room along with the telescopes used by Thompson to teach thousands of students about the earth and sky. The rocks, minerals, bugs, and animal tracks found throughout the 550-acre park are on display created by Thompson for her hands-on approach to teaching. She put her soul into her work, She used to say, I get paid to play in the creek and chase butterflies, said her daughter. The passion and enthusiasm Thompson brought to her role as site interpreter won't be easily replaced, said Mary Mitchell Stites, president of the Weldon Springs Foundation, a nonprofit group that supports the park. She left a big hole. She was an awesome teacher who was always searching for new experiences in the realm of nature, said Mitchell Stites. Thompson built her own curriculum for the schools, said Mitchell Stites, starting with what's around you and then building out. When she realized the dire prognosis of her cancer that was diagnosed in June 2014, Thompson shared her priorities for the park with Mitchell Stites. Among her wishes was more purple martin houses, something the foundation will purchase with memorial donations. The foundation also plans to continue Thompson's work, including the interpretive center and an annual fishing derby. Given Illinois' dire budget condition, it's not known if or when the site interpreter position will be filled, said the foundation president. Gary Thompson, husband of the late naturalist, agreed she touched so many lives. Now, she's really going to be missed. They all loved her, he said during a recent visit to the interpretive center. John Baker, a member of the Park Foundation board, served with Thompson on the Clinton Tree Commission. We spent a lot of time together counting trees, said Baker, who relied upon Thompson's knowledge to complete an inventory of trees along Clinton's boulevards. The commission plans to plant 10 trees next spring in Thompson's memory. Thompson's work in and out of the classroom was honored in 1989 when she traveled to the White House to receive the Take Pride in America Award, and Lauren Thompson recently accepted the Community Volunteer Award for Those Who Excel from the Illinois State Board of Education in her mother's honor. In government and politics, Illinois pilots grounded in budget fight. Springfield. Five state airplane pilots spent the first quarter of Illinois' fiscal year showing up at their jobs with little chance of leaving the ground. The reason? Beginning in July, Governor Bruce Rauner grounded the state air shuttle that ferried state workers and lawmakers between Springfield and Chicago as part of a budget-cutting plan designed to save an estimated $3 million. Data provided by the Transportation Agency through a Freedom of Information Act request shows that the shuttles flew 136 times in 3 months leading up to Rauner's decree. Afterwards, records show the planes took off zero times. Yet the same five pilots who formerly flew the planes were still on the payroll, earning a combined $39,500 per month. In October, one of the five pilots voluntarily left the state workforce. DOT spokesman Gary Trigell said that more could be on their way out. We currently are going to, through the layoff process, to reduce the number to two union pilots, Trigell said. The grounded pilots, each of whom earn more than $100,000 annually, are part of a growing theme that has hit state government during the ongoing budget impasse. On October 1st, Rauner closed the Illinois State Museum as part of his budget-cutting push. But because of a lawsuit and union rules, 43 workers at the museum continue to report for duty. Officials say many of the museum employees are working on research projects while they are awaiting their fate. Before Rauner grounded the shuttle flights, the state would run commuter planes on two round trips between Springfield and Chicago. Records show in the final days of the shuttle it was filled primarily by Democratic lawmakers and administration staff who needed to be in each city for daily meetings. But the planes had become controversial as lawmakers looked for ways to cut costs during the tight budget times. In a process launched before Rauner took office, the state began selling off some of its air fleet, netting $2.5 million. The fleet is less than half of the size it was 2 years ago, with three Beechcraft King Air passenger planes, one Sikorsky helicopter, and four single-engine Cessnas. The pilots weren't completely grounded in the aftermath of the shuttle cancellation. Trigell said they spent some time doing airport safety inspections, aerial surveys, and responding to emergencies. Along with the pending layoffs of pilots, union officials say IDOT's aeronautics division is being cut by seven more workers, including aircraft technicians, dispatchers, and clerical staff. State Representative Sue Shearer, Democrat of Decatur, is among the lawmakers who have been calling for an end to the state's reliance on airplanes. She said she's pleased that some of the costs are going down, but she said there's more work to be done. I continue to believe that the money the state spends on planes, their operation, and staff is not a good use of taxpayer dollars, Shearer said in a statement. I believe these tax dollars could be better spent providing medical care for sick seniors, treatment and screenings for women with breast cancer, or a myriad of other important programs not currently being funded. The play's the thing. South Shore's kindergartners bring Thanksgiving book to life. Rio Pilger's mom put her hair in two braids and with a quiver of arrows and the construction paper feathers in her headband. The kindergartner looked the part of Samoset at South Shore Schools on Thursday for the Thanksgiving play. "To celebrate Thanksgiving," said teacher Lorraine Major. She and fellow kindergarten teacher Lacey Wood taught the students about the pilgrims and the hardships of living in those times. "We told them that children had to work all day," Major said. "Excuse me. It wasn't easy living then. They had no idea. They don't have the background to know all that. As children have done for years, the little ones made pilgrim hats, both men's and women's, and Native American headbands with paper feathers, to portray the attendees at the first Thanksgiving meal. Shea Risley portrayed the Mayflower with a big smile. Emorius Jeffro was Plymouth Rock, and Jace Austin portrayed a snug house the pilgrims were able to build out of the abundant trees they found in their new homeland. The play was based on the book Thanksgiving Day by Anne Rockwell. The story is about a group of children putting on a play, and Stephen Wood, who read the book, inserted the names of the South Shore's children who were playing the parts. "The kids only had two full dress rehearsals," Major said. "I was nervous," she admitted with a laugh, "but they did great. Learning to perform and memorizing the songs and movements that went along with them is an important skill at this age," said Liz Barnaby, the music teacher. "Memorization is easier when the words are put to music. It's the rhythm and the melody," Barnaby said. "One of the reasons we sang the first song was they had something to do with their hands. They're very quick to pick things up, and you teach them a little, and then a little more, and add it as you go. The repetition is important." Sanitary District eyes lower tax asking. Decatur. Unlike many other government bodies in Macon County, the Sanitary District of Decatur is contemplating a slight decrease in its property tax levy for the next year. Interim Executive Director Kent Newton presented the proposal to the Sanitary District Board Wednesday, with the board slated to vote at its December 16th meeting. Newton credited the district's long-term planning with helping to keep the levy essentially flat. Property taxes generally pay for capital improvements, which are scheduled 15 years into the future. So there might be, in the future, times where we need to increase taxes, but that will be driven by reinvesting in our infrastructure for the public, Newton said. Operating expenses this year budgeted at $12.2 million are covered by user fees, expected to be $13.8 million. The $3,558,500 levy is about $1,400 less than the previous years. Based on a projected 1.3% increase in property values, the tax rate would be roughly 34 cents per $100 of equalized assessed valuation. The owner of a $77,500 home would pay $68.18 under the projection, a 91-cent decrease from the previous year's bill. Property taxes account for only about 19.8% of the district's total revenue, with user fees making up 76.2%. The remaining 4% comes from a variety of other sources. Newton said the $26 million capital budget includes the entire cost of several capital projects. Because most projects take multiple years to complete, the district won't spend the full budgeted amount in the fiscal year that ends April 30th. Jam the Jars, a rich tradition for Maroa Forsyth. Maroa. Morning in Maroa Forsyth Middle School begins with students filing into the gym for announcements, and during November, Jam the Jars. Signs posted along the balcony give the weight totals for the change dropped into the jars, one each for 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. 8th grade always wins, said Lydia Hubbard, who's been donating annually since 6th grade, and this year, as an 8th grader, will likely be in the winning class. The money benefits the Christmas Project, begun by former police chief Leo Plant more than 25 years ago, an effort to provide a merrier Christmas to families in the school district who are in need. We ask students to bring in loose change and fill up the jars, said Rebecca Nashland, student council sponsor. I weigh them and see who's ahead by weight. At the end, we take the money to the bank, and whoever wins gets a reward, but all the money pays for the perishable items that go into the Christmas baskets. At one time, students collected food and filled the balcony area with it, said Barbara Hastings, a school bus driver and the coordinator of the Christmas project, along with Barb Wilkie of Maroa. As the years have gone by and the effort has become streamlined, various community entities have taken specific roles. The middle school raises money for perishables. The elementary school, and sometimes the high school too, hold food drives for non-perishables. The Maroa Fire Department is where the food is sorted and the boxes are packed for delivery. The churches and schools help identify families in need. It's truly a community effort, Hastings said. The reward for the class who donates the most is bragging rights, Nashland said, and usually a breakfast of donuts and orange juice. The breakfast and the bragging rights are fun, said eighth grader Lindy Kuhn, but the real satisfaction is in helping someone. Some of the kids here might be the ones we're helping, she said. And here's some news briefs. Normal, ISU building evacuated. Hazardous material experts were called to investigate a suspicious package reported by a professor Thursday afternoon at Schroeder Hall at Illinois State University. ISU officials at 4:41 p.m. ordered the evacuation of the fourth floor. The package was in the faculty office area for the Politics and Government and Criminal Justice departments. A professor reported receiving a smallish package that seemed suspicious in some unspecified way, said ISU spokesman Eric Joan. It arrived via the university mail system. The professor called ISU police, who called the Normal Fire Department. The Bloomington Fire Department's hazardous materials response team was called to investigate. Jones said the university has protocols for responding to such incidents, regardless of external factors such as the attacks in Paris. I think we would have taken these precautions anyway, Jones said. Decatur, Mangan lecture is set. Fred Spanaus, a community activist, consultant, a member of the Decatur School Board, will give the 2014 Father Martin Mangan lecture at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, December 1st, at the Madden Auditorium of the Decatur Public Library at 130 North Franklin Street. Spanaus will discuss the motives and methods of Mangan, who served Decatur St. James Parish from 1991 until his death in 2001. A local Friends of MITS group, headed by Bob Sampson, has been keeping his ideals alive through annual lecture ever since. Soon after Mangan came to Decatur, he gained national prominence for his efforts on behalf of locked out A.E. Staley Manufacturing Company workers and striking workers at Caterpillar Incorporated and, Bridgestone Firestone Incorporated. Mattoon, vehicle hits auditorium. Mattoon police said Thursday they didn't know yet why a vehicle hit Burgess Osborne Auditorium and caused other damage Wednesday evening. The compact sports utility vehicle caused extensive damage to the historical auditorium at 1701 Wabash Avenue and also hit a business sign and a street sign, Mattoon Police Deputy Chief Jason Taylor said. The driver, Jeremy W. Hargis, 35, of Mattoon, hasn't been questioned yet because he was taken to Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana immediately after the accident, Taylor said. A Carl representative said there was no information available on Hargis's condition. Information on the extent of the damage to the auditorium wasn't available. The incident damaged at least two rooms of the structure but spared the nearby bathrooms on the northeast side of the building. Forsyth, small fire at Bergner's. Firefighters responded to a fire alarm call at the Bergner store in Forsyth's Hickory Point Mall on Thursday morning. but Hickory Point Fire Protection District Chief Dennis Downey said it happily turned out to be no big deal. An electrical wire shorted out and a little bitty piece of paper put out some smoke, said Downey. He said the notepad-sized paper had fallen into a cavity behind a drawer in a lighted display case in the store's jewelry section. It had probably been down there for who knows how long, added Downey, and then this electrical line shorted out a little bit. The chief said firefighters quickly dealt with the fire about 9:40 a.m., and estimated damage to the display area was minimal. Decatur, Attic Treasures Event. Treasures from the Attic event will be held 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, November 21st at the Macon County History Museum, 5580 North Fork Road in Decatur. Appraiser Edwin Walker will be appraising items at a cost of $20 per two items. The donations support the History Museum. Call 217-422-4919. That's 422-4919. Street closing scheduled. South Ewing Street at West Decatur Street will be closed from 7 a.m. to noon today for tree removal. Homeowners will have access, but no through traffic will be allowed. On Biz, Bell's Jewelry, Bodine's Baking Company, Sheer Learning Academy of Cosmetology. All that glitters will soon be sold at Bell's Jewelry in Decatur. The business, which has been in the Bell family and a downtown fixture for nearly 70 years, is closing down. Owner Doug Bell said inventory is valued at $500,000, is now being sold off. Current stock includes wedding rings, gemstone jewelry, and men's and women's watches, with discounts up to 70% off. The liquidation sale started Thursday and continues from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Friday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday, and 1 to 5 p.m. Sunday. The business is located at 112 East Prairie Avenue and can be reached at 217-422-1814. That's 422-1814. Amanda and Jason Bodine decided this summer to take their newly developed interest in baking to the next level. By the end of September, they had constructed and opened a licensed and health department-inspected commercial kitchen in their Decatur home. It happened very quickly, Amanda Bodine said, and we wanted to do our business right from the start. Bodine's Baking Company offers a variety of made-from-scratch treats, she said, and they're expecting a busy holiday season. As Amanda Bodine said, sugar cookies alone were a hit last year for family and friends. The sugar cookies are made with buttercream icing, she said. They also make items including cakes, pies, and fudge, Amanda Bodine said. Jason Bodine does most of the decorating, as his wife credits his amazing artistic ability. Having the kitchen at their house allows Amanda to homeschool their children and keep costs low while starting the business. It's a delivery-based business serving Decatur and surrounding communities, she said. Eventually, they hope to expand to a storefront. Bodine's Baking Company can be found on Facebook or call 217-853-7707. That's 853-7707. Sheer Learning Academy of Cosmetology at 241 North Main Street is under new ownership. Rebecca Ricky Wright also owns Positive Reflection Salon in Decatur. Bought the business from Leah Stukens last month and started classes October 13th with the next 9-week session to begin January 5th. A student salon will also open at that time. Wright's staff includes Christy Sams, the school's administrator, and instructors Shannon Johnson and Ashley Blue. For more information, visit www.shearlearning.com or call 425-9117. That's 425-9117. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated November 20th, 2015. This is Barbara Ridenour. Please stay tuned.